Deborah Medlin knows all too well the shortage of psychiatrists in central Illinois. Her son Zach had to wait 6 months to see a doctor, and he wound up in the emergency room instead.
If he'd seen the doctor earlier, when I had first called, it wouldn't have escalated to the point of him being hospitalized.
To meet the growing demand for psychiatric care, a number of providers like Jan Ayton with the Douglas County Mental Health Center are looking to the internet to reach patients.
It's probably inevitable that eventually we will have to go to the telepsychiatry.
I'm Scott Cameron. The benefits and the drawbacks of telepsychiatry, that's coming up on Focus after this news. Good morning, I'm Scott Cameron, and this is Focus from Illinois Public Media. Well, this week on Morning Edition, we've heard about the shortages of psychiatrists in central Illinois and the lengths some will go to find care if they can find it at all. It's all part of our series, Unmet Needs, Living with Mental Illness in Central Illinois. The series runs all this month. As hospitals and other mental health care providers look for ways to better serve their patients, many are taking a second look at the practice of telepsychiatry. If you work in mental health or if you're a patient, have you tried telepsychiatry? Would you, if it was offered to you? Give us a call, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. You can also find us on Twitter at Focus580. We'll talk with a doctor and an administrator offering telepsychiatry here in a few minutes. But first, what's driving the need for services like telepsychiatry? Donna Mayer joins us in Studio C. Donna, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for airing about an illness that needs to be brought to the forefront.
Yeah, shining a light on an important topic. Now, you live in Coles County.
Yes.
Your son diagnosed with a mental illness. You've jumped through all sorts of hoops, from what I see here, to get him the care that he needs. All right, let's go back a little bit. What happened when you first realized that something wasn't quite right?
Well, he was hospitalized, and it was just like a nightmare. Here you are in a hospital, and your son's seeing trees moving in the yard and cameras in any nail hole in the wall watching him and thinking that people was going to get him. And you think, what's going on? I've never been around anything like this. And it's just devastating. What am I going to do? You know, I'm the only person going through this. That's exactly what I thought.
Very alone.
And I did not know it was going to be such a long journey whenever it started. I was telling earlier that whenever he had his first in-hospital breakdown, they told my husband and I that they never thought he would get any better than what he was now.
The doctor said that to you, that he's never going to get better?
No, that they didn't know whether he would.
Didn't know, okay.
And they wanted us to be prepared. But they were willing to work with him.
Okay.
And stuff, and which I'm really thankful for.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that time, he had good insurance because he had been working. And they did work with him, and we got to see the doctor in Decatur. And, in fact, John would not take his medicine. And somehow they got it court-ordered that he had to take his medicine.
And John is your son?
Yes, John is my son. And so he started taking the medicine, and he felt like he could go back to work. They didn't really want him to go back to work because I think they felt like the pressure would be too much for him.
The doctors or his workplace?
The doctor.
Okay.
They just did not want him to. And but John insisted, and the psychologist said, well, he had some connection of where my son worked, and he said, let me see if I can get him a job where the pressure won't be there.
Hmm.
So they did, but it didn't last.
It didn't last.
He just could not. He started thinking that people were after him and all the paranoia, and also my son was dual diagnosed with alcoholism. So, which is really another thing, which it is hard to get dual diagnosis care, too.
And is that a common thing where in terms of maybe trying to self-medicate to
yes,
some degree
yes.
and deal with the...
Yes, it is. But, you know, at the time, I was new to all this.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what he'd do whenever he'd go off his medication because he'd think he was better. Then he would self-medicate and the whole process would start all over. And I was working at a job where I was working 10 to 12 hours a day trying to drive to Decatur, Illinois to get him to his appointments. It was just, it was too much. So we knew that the doctor in our area, which we had very few at the time, was in his network. And I should have probably never changed doctors, but I did, and that's a mistake. But you learn as you go along.
Right. How could you know?
You are going to make mistakes, and you are going to learn that who is a good doctor for somebody else in this may not be the right one for your loved one.
Right. And until you meet that person and have that experience, you're not going to know
You're not going to know that.
And so you're facing a shortage of doctors, it sounds like, already. There's not many to choose from. You're trying to find the best doctor to fit your son. And what happens?
And what happens is after he started going there, well, his insurance, because at the time he got sick, your insurance, you had a spin down on mental health and, drug substance abuse.
So a spin down meaning after a while they say, okay,
you can only spend this much in your, and it was gone. His coverage was gone.
And was he still working at that point?
No, he had been off again from that point. Yeah, and it was kind of a bad deal because we went on and paid his COBRA a couple of months before to keep him on.
Mm-hmm.
But he was still on the medical part, but as far as anything to do with mental illness and substance abuse, they would pay no more.
They were, okay, that was all done then.
So we had to find a place to take him, which is really hard because we were trying to get away from this doctor. We had went to Coles County to get, we were trying to get him away from there.
Yeah,
because
it didn't work out.
Well, no, because if you don't have insurance, you don't have a medical card or anything, and they kept on refusing him a medical card.
Oh, the Medicaid card? They wouldn't, why were they refusing him a Medicaid card?
Well, for one, I feel like it was because he was still living with my husband and I.
So they were counting, viewing your income as his income, and he wouldn't qualify.
Yes, and at the hospital, they wanted John, my husband, and I to be responsible, I feel like, for his medical bill because we filled out the financial thing there.
And how old is your son at the time?
At the time, he was 28 years old.
28 years old.
Yeah, he was not, but where else was he going to live?
Right, but then for them to view him as still a dependent of yours, that's a complicated thing.
And the only way we finally, I don't know whether this is what did it, because I'm going to be perfectly honest with you what the deal was. My husband talked to the person in finance at our hospital because we were arguing with him because he was responsible for his own bills. We were just giving him food and shelter.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband finally told him, he said, well, do you want us to give him an address under the footbridge by the railroad tracks?
Said this to the hospital?
Yes, my husband said that to the hospital. Is that what you want?
Yeah, what'd they do?
Well, I piped in and told him what I had heard about some of their practices, about some people get them. He got his financial.
No kidding. So it took an advocate to say, this is not right, something needs to change, and it worked.
And it worked. So we got him, but then it was still, he had to see that doctor there, and it wasn't working. My son was getting worse instead of better.
So still seeing a doctor, but not improving.
Not improving. And so I knew I had to get him somewhere, and he had seen that doctor for over 2 years where we were fighting all these issues, and somebody told me about a great place up here in Champaign, which you guys are very fortunate that you have doctors.
Mm-hmm.
That volunteer to do this at the Champaign County Christian Health Center.
Hmm.
And he got to see a psychiatrist there because he had no insurance. And they see people without insurance. And that was the greatest turning point for us because it was a doctor my son clicked with. Plus, he had gotten a counselor at our mental health center that was good. And it all started kind of falling into place. And she finally talked him into moving into a group home, which we finally got him qualified for a medical card then so we could get those meds. Because before that, I was having to fill out papers and give them to the doctor to fill out to go to the drug companies, which the drug companies are good about furnishing medicine for people in need.
Mm.
You just have to find out where to go and how to do it
do the paperwork.
Mm-hmm. But the problem with the Champaign County Christian Health Center was that's not a full-time job. So whenever those medicines came in the mail, if nobody was there, they sent them back to the drug company.
Oh, gee. So we've been talking quite a bit this week about access issues. And from you, I mean, I'm hearing that, one, there was a shortage in Coles County of just mental health professionals to begin with. The insurance issues, being able to afford care in certain cases, that's an access issue. And then finding a place that will take your son to a place that will do it without insurance, and yet they're struggling with their own financial issues, I'm sure, and are limited in the services they can provide and the amount of time they can dedicate to this. I mean, that's quite – you've been through a lot to get to that and have been a heck of an advocate, it sounds like. How is he doing now?
He's doing a lot better. He went from group home to like a semi-group setting where there was just an apartment manager there like mm-hmm. for 4 hours. And now he's in an apartment by himself, but they're through our mental health center. And he still has his times, but he is so much better than what we ever thought he would be when this started out, because I'm just thankful.
I can hear the relief in your voice as you say that.
Oh, I am. And I just, you know, I tell everybody, whenever this first started, I felt kind of like maybe a person, whenever they find out their loved one has cancer,
mm-hmm.
you can either let that cancer beat you or you can try to beat that cancer.
Yeah, you said no way.
No way am I going to, because we have been through a lot of things. Like before my son, also, it's hard finding an attorney that will take somebody for a disability whenever they're dual diagnosed. And I feel like this is something that should be brought up, because alcoholism does not qualify for disability.
Oh, I see.
So we had a battle because this doctor that my son did not have a good rapport with, he had wrote in the records that it was all due to alcoholism.
It was all due to alcoholism.
Well, he felt like if he would quit drinking, that he would get rid of the psychotic stuff. But he would do the psychotic stuff and then start drinking. So, see, and we were getting nowhere on that. That's why I'm saying it's just really hard to...
to navigate all of this.
Yes, and we had an attorney for him who said, no, I'm not going to take the case.
Oh, wow, okay.
Well, this is an attorney that was probably well known. He was supposed to be. But we found an attorney up here who I want her to know, if she hears this, that we think she's great, because she said, I'm not afraid of one doctor.
And she took care of it, huh?
Well, it took her a long time, but she took care of it.
All right. Well, that's it. Donna Mayer is with us and will remain with us here. We're talking about the challenges of finding mental health care in Central Illinois, as we're hearing, too few psychiatrists to meet a growing demand in many cases, among other issues, and the promise and problems related to telemedicine as one potential solution. Donna Mayer with us, talking about her experience getting help for her son. And joining us now is Harry Wallen. He's CEO of the Mason District Hospital in Havana, Illinois. They're treating patients right now with telepsychiatry. Harry Wallen joins me on the line from the hospital there. Welcome to Focus.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Sure, thanks for joining us here. Is Donna's experience here representative in terms of access issues and having a shortage of doctors to go to? Does that reflect some of what you're seeing there in patients in and around Havana?
Yeah, it's not unheard of. It's a very complex issue with many medical issues, many financial issues. Oftentimes, individuals who are suffering from mental illness, add on to that the dual diagnosis of alcoholism, or in other cases, other forms of addiction, find it very difficult to maintain employment. And with that, you heard her situation with her son's challenges in getting coverage under the state Medicaid program. Those financing issues are not uncommon. The challenge that she didn't talk about that is also a problem that we face is lack of public transportation for individuals to, you know, when they can get access to a provider, how do they get to their appointment?
Yeah, there's no bus service in many rural areas.
Yeah, and that adds on to, in many cases, the challenges that people experience who are suffering from mental illnesses and other behavioral conditions. So it's a number of very real challenges. Obviously, not for everybody, but her situation that she related is not at all uncommon.
So you, with that kind of context and background, knowing there's a shortage of area issues of access, transportation, you wanted to hire a psychiatrist to work with patients one-on-one there in Havana. What happened?
Well, it just became a challenge. We couldn't find anybody is the simple answer. The problems that we face are, A, financial. Two, it's we are in a rural, somewhat isolated part of the state. And given the shortage of physicians, finding someone who is interested in relocating their family, their practice, their career to Havana on a full-time basis was something that we were unsuccessful in accomplishing.
So there are many doctors who... They're attracted, I suppose, to big cities, to bright lights.
Well,
to,
or other opportunities. When you're in a shortage situation and can pick where you would like to live, where you'd like to raise your family, a lot of things go into people's decision-making process as to where they would like to live. When there are numerous opportunities that they have, they choose what for them is the best match and fit for their family and their professional desires, and we didn't make the check mark on when we were in that process of trying to find someone. Then we began looking to see if there was someone on a part-time basis who would want to, you know, from some of the neighboring community.
Yeah, or share resources with another community
might
or something.
Be willing or interested in coming over here on a part-time basis. And again, we were unsuccessful in that regard again.
So there's a clear need. You're not able to bring somebody in-house anyway, on a full-time or a part-time basis. What brought you to telepsychiatry then?
Well, I was researching, attending some conferences. Actually, it was a conference being put on by the Illinois Rural Health Association. They have an annual meeting each year, and the focus of their discussion that year was on psychiatric services. And so a presentation presented that talked about some of the advantages of telepsychiatry that were being used in other parts of the country, presenting some scientific evidence showing the success factors, the strengths of the program, the weaknesses of the program. And as we began our evaluation, considering the fact that we had absolutely no services at all, saw that the advantages that such a program brings to the population would be providing value to the residents of our community. As good as having a full-time psychiatrist? Probably not, but far better than having no access to psychiatric services at all.
Yeah, so in terms of what, until we really started doing the research on this, I wasn't even aware that this was happening in many places right now. Can you walk us through what happens in telepsychiatry? How does it work? What's the process? What does it look like?
Well, our service has been in place for several years now, so we've worked out some of the learning process that goes along with this. But in our counseling office, in the office that we use where the patients come, they check in, it's staffed by either a counselor or a nurse, depending on scheduling on our side and who the providers are and who the patients are.
So the patient comes into your offices where they're with that person and in front of a video screen.
Exactly. And it's just a high-definition TV screen that is high-speed video conferencing. It's no different than sitting across the room from an individual. The quality of the TV screen is very high quality. The audio quality is very strong. There's no delays. We're using high-speed broadband for our connectivity. And so the two individuals can sit and have a discussion. There's a camera mounted there so that the physician on the remote side can see the patient as clearly as the patient can see the psychiatrist.
And in your case, where are the doctors?
In Springfield, Illinois, about 60 miles away. A couple of the physicians can, part of an organization that's based out of Chicago, but their physicians themselves are based in Springfield. We also work with the SIU School of Medicine, Department of Behavioral Health, and they're located in Springfield.
And in Havana there, how many patients are doing telepsychiatry?
Well, we have a waiting list that goes for several months to even get an appointment. We have two different programs, one with adults and one with children and adolescents.
So the response has been pretty robust.
Yeah, I mean, it's been viewed by many of our patients as a very positive opportunity and experience, getting them the help that they need, the contact and evaluation discussions with their physician as needed. It's not for everybody. All of the patients haven't found it helpful. We have a number of folks who don't show up for their appointments. That's challenging for us because we have people on a waiting list where if they knew they weren't coming, we could have gotten somebody else in. But it's still those sorts of challenges that take place. We provide the program on a weekly basis for adults and or one of the two programs are running every week. And been very well supported by the folks in the community. Again, not for everybody. All the patients haven't found it to meet their needs. And some of those folks go without care, and some of those folks beg, borrow, or find a way to get to a psychiatrist in a community an hour away or so, or farther.
Yeah, and we've been talking here with, we started the show with Donna Mayer, her son diagnosed multiple diagnoses of mental illness. Donna, bringing you back into the conversation, you were presented with the option of telepsychiatry for your son. What did you say?
I said no because I wanted him to have more of a rapport with a doctor because we had seen how that had worked in the past with previous doctor. I feel like if they don't have a rapport, but after listening to this doctor explain some of the things, I would, if it was the only care I could get my son, I'd be in line, beg, borrow, and steal, and to get in line.
Yeah, you're in that category.
And I admire you for finding help for people who couldn't make those trips because I think that the public is unaware of how many people with mental illness do not have families at all anymore, or for some reason there's not anybody there. And they have to worry about getting somewhere to get the help they need, to get the prescriptions for the meds they need. Because I've seen these people without meds. And I admire you for doing that for your area.
Harry Wallen, do you find that people are skeptical at first, and once they hear the information, they hear what you described, just like Donna just said, it starts to click?
Yeah, I think some people are skeptical. Some people have been reassured. I mean, a lot of these patients are seeing primary care physicians in the community who, when there isn't a psychiatrist available, they are the only physicians able to assist these individuals with their care. Recognizing the need for psychiatric services is not the problem. It's getting those patients a referral in to see a psychiatrist is the challenge. And where that isn't available, those primary care physicians are able to explain the process, introduce them to the counselors, introduce them to the nurses, who are the staff people on the local side of the conversation. And that has helped in some cases to allay those apprehensions, that nervousness that comes from being uncertain. Other people find it very helpful not to have that rapport, if you would, that one-on-one contact, but still able to have that conversation over the television screen. The fact that there is a counselor or nurse in the room, so some of those non-audio sorts of nervousness or questions that might arise because there isn't a face-to-face contact, yeah, can be communicated and shared, recent histories and things. So records are available to the psychiatrists. You know, in the case of SIU, we also have the benefit in working with their program, with their teaching program, to expose some of our new psychiatrists or psychiatrists in training, I guess, might be the better way, the folks who are in a couple of years going to be psychiatrists out in the field,
mm-hmm,
get that exposure to the telepsychiatry and get to participate in that process as part of their education and training.
And Donna Mayer, just briefly here, you had mentioned that they're in thinking about needing that face-to-face contact, or originally thinking you needed that face-to-face contact, your son did, I suppose I should say.
Uh-huh.
You referenced that there had been some issues that led you to think that. What happened?
Well, what happened was is we had lost our psychiatrist at the mental health center there in Coles County. She was leaving, and so they couldn't find anybody because we had the same issue. Who wants, you know, we live in a small area,
yeah.
And people usually want their kids where there's a good school curriculum, which you don't have. They've got good school curriculum. I'm not saying that, but they don't have a lot of the sports and other stuff you can.
The extras, yeah.
Yeah, that they do like offering Champaign Urbana even.
So as your son was trying to see a doctor and things, where would that face-to-face contact make a real difference, do you think?
For me, as my son is such a manipulator, but after listening to him, I don't know if they could have seen him on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
It might have been better because he probably would have acted out more.
What do you think? What do you mean by manipulator?
Anything to make him think that nothing's going on because he does not still like taking his medicine. He would like for them to think that he doesn't need it.
And you said earlier that he sometimes will not acknowledge that he has a mental illness.
Yeah, sometimes that is really hard for him too, and then other times he accepts it. He knows, you know, that there's things that he used to be able to do
mm-hmm.
that he cannot do anymore.
All right, we are talking about the lack of access to good mental health care in Central Illinois and one potential solution, telepsychiatry. Up next here in just a moment, we'll hear from a doctor who treats patients by video link and actually helped set up the program here in Havana and other telemedicine programs, all part of our month-long series, Unmet Needs, Living with Mental Illness in Central Illinois. And join us also online, Twitter chat. We're talking about mental illness there and some of the stigma that exists in Central Illinois. If this is something that you've experienced, join that conversation as well on Twitter using the hashtag WillChat. Stay with us. It's Focus from Illinois Public Media. Yeah, this is Focus from Illinois Public Media. Welcome back. I'm Scott Cameron. Federal data show that downstate Illinois suffers from widespread gaps in mental health care. There just aren't enough psychiatrists to meet the growing demand, especially in many rural areas. For years, VA hospitals, among others, have offered telepsychiatry to improve access to care and to keep costs down in some cases. Some hospitals are experimenting with telepsychiatry for faster consultations with patients in the emergency room as well. We're talking today about the promise and some of the limits of telemedicine. Now, if you work in mental health, if you're a patient, have you tried telepsychiatry? Would you try it if it was offered to you? Give us a call, 800-222-9455. You can email us, will-talk@illinois.edu. Also, the conversation going on Twitter that I just mentioned, @Focus580. Our guests are Harry Wallen, CEO of Mason District Hospital in Havana, Illinois, a hospital that offers telepsychiatry. Donna Mayer, she cares for her son who has a mental illness and chose not to do telepsychiatry, at least in part because she felt that her son could manipulate the doctor without face-to-face contact. And joining us now is Dr. Jeffrey Bennett. He serves as acting chief of the Adult Psychiatry Division at Southern Illinois University School of Medicine. In Springfield, he treats patients by telepsychiatry, teaches others to do the same. And he worked with Harry Wallen's hospital to set up their program, joined us now by phone from his office. Doctor, welcome to Focus.
Thank you very much for having me.
So let's back up a little bit here. How long has telepsych been around?
Oh, it's been around for well over 20 to 30 years. As soon as telemonitors were around, people have tried to do various kinds of treatment. And in fact, some of the first treatments that were done were forms of group therapy. So, but the resolution and the audio was very different back then. And over the time that we've been doing telepsychiatry, even over the past 4 or 5 years, there's just been such an impressive increase in the quality of both the auditory and visual resolution of the way the video conferencing works that we still find that the technology is far in advance of the administration and the legal aspects of it. So.
So as technology has progressed, high-speed internet has expanded at other places.
Sure.
It's allowed this type of service to reach out to places that were underserved already and now have a capability to reach it using this kind of technology.
Yeah, and there's an important caveat that, you know, Skyping has been around for a long time and very successful at communication. One of the difficulties is maintaining the security of the connection because
mm-hmm.
you want to be sure that if you're speaking with a patient about confidential issues, that it's compatible with the confidentiality that patients need through HIPAA.
Well, how do you overcome that, or how do you ensure that, I guess?
We have a specifically dedicated T-line connecting us to the different places that we serve, and we also have several firewalls. So the connectivity is very carefully...
So a T-line, like a direct internet connection.
Correct.
Bridging you from the locations you're at, and then firewalls and software to further protect it.
Correct.
Okay. In terms of, we've talked a bit about, you know, the reasons people use telepsychiatry. There have been a couple of studies, primarily done from what I could tell through the VA, that showed improved outcomes with telepsychiatry when compared to receiving no care at all. There seems to be limited research in terms of whether telepsychiatry works as well as face-to-face meetings with a doctor. What do we know about how this works and how well it works?
We know a lot about the quality of diagnostics using telepsychiatry. We know a lot about how patients perceive it in terms of their satisfaction. We know a lot about the satisfaction of primary care physicians who receive this as a service by participating psychiatrists, and generally very, very favorable. The ability for a telepsychiatrist to diagnose depression is almost identical with what they can do, say, in an office-based face-to-face interchange. I think the areas that are still undergoing research are things like how do patients feel over time talking to somebody on a TV? Do they divulge as much information? Do they? Is it easier for them to not tell the truth? And I think that's an interesting area. We're working on that, and we're actually doing research to understand more about the doctor-patient interaction here at SIU. so there certainly are areas of developing research, but by and large, the quality of a consultative diagnostic is very, very accurate.
Do you find, or does research show that some people tend to be more helped by telepsychiatry than others?
Well, that's a harder thing to
quantify.
Yeah, if you have access to a psychiatrist, then it's harder to get. And why would you go see a telepsychiatrist? So doing that kind of comparison, I think, is very difficult. There is data, I think, about the show rates. I have an interesting anecdotal statement, and that is somebody I know who practices telepsychiatry routinely sees patients in person at a mental health center, but also has a telepsychiatry clinic at a different mental health center, and sometimes at the same mental health center when they're not able to make it at a distance. And what he finds is that the show rate for the telepsychiatry clinic is better than the show rate for his in-person treatment.
So show rate meaning who shows up.
Yeah. So does that suggest that the patients are more comfortable speaking to somebody through a video conference rather than face-to-face? It's a hard thing to quantify, but that's a possibility.
Hmm. Now, let me ask it a little different way then. Who are there certain types of people who are best helped by telepsychiatry? Well, we've talked about rural areas. Are there other folks who tend to benefit specifically from telepsychiatry as an option?
People who don't have psychiatric care, I think, benefit from having the option for seeing a psychiatrist through telepsychiatry. I'm not sure that... let me sort of back up, because one of the things that I'm doing is I'm still learning, and the way I got into telepsychiatry was that I was asked by the person running our telehealth service if I was interested in developing a training clinic.
Hmm.
So I got into this as an educator and somebody that's interested in training future psychiatrists and physicians on how to work with patients.
Yeah. Well, one thing, what I was getting at was I had seen something where people who are deaf, in some cases, it really helps them because some of the issues with transportation and things that Harry Wallen had talked about earlier and not having enough interpreters to go around. So telepsychiatry gave them an opportunity in a single location to treat many people. Veterans, we mentioned the VA hospital, children with some schools in some cases, it sounds like. It opens some doors.
If access is a problem, then it's been remarkable how helpful it's been. I think a great example would be, say, the prison population, where transporting a patient from an inpatient from a prison setting to a psychiatrist many miles away, as the only option for obtaining psychiatric care, is very expensive. It's potentially dangerous. But it's care that very often is extremely important, very beneficial for the prisoner. And if you can do telepsychiatry into the prison, then it saves tremendous amounts of administrative and financial effort.
So thinking, coming back to Havana, you helped set up the system there. What did you have to think about? What kind of factors do you take into consideration when you look at a community and its needs and start setting up a service like that?
That's a great question. I think one of the important things is that we practice here in a city where there are lots of resources that are not available in rural areas. The transportation issue is very, very prominent. But we also don't know what kind of therapists are available. We don't know whether they have the same kinds of diagnostic equipment. And so the process of evaluating somebody through telepsychiatry, I think, is sort of a stepwise process. And if we decide that somebody needs to get an MRI because we're not sure whether they've got a brain tumor that's causing their symptoms versus having some kind of psychological stressor, is that kind of resource available? So in advance, having meetings with the organization that we're working with to plan out those kinds of resources, what's available, what's not available, and in planning with a specific patient, if we make recommendations for therapy, can they make it to that therapist on a regular basis? Can they make it the two-hour drive to the nearest substance abuse treatment facility and so on? So planning resources is really important. The other thing is learning to get just getting to know the people who are making the referrals, understanding what their needs are. So well in advance of actually seeing patients, we spent some time setting up this clinic and having several meetings with the staff at Mason District Hospital, as well as our own coordinating staff, as well as our information technology staff, to really work out the details of how that time on would be most efficient and how our consultative recommendations could be most beneficial. And we actually routinely would have our medical students and our residents take a road trip and visit Mason District Hospital so they got to know the doctors they were working with and who were referring patients.
And Harry Wolland, head of Mason District Hospital there in Havana, referenced that partnership between the telepsychiatrist and the doctors in Springfield, and I suppose they could be anywhere, in this case they are in Springfield, and the primary care doctors, the assistants and things back in Havana. Harry, coming back to you for a moment here, in thinking about that partnership and that relationship, things like medication, I mean, how is that handled? Who prescribes medications?
Well, it is either one of two ways. It's either the psychiatrist or the psychiatrist having a conversation and referral then to the patient's primary care physician. There are different ways that it works, but it's based on the professional recommendations of the psychiatrist, either by prescribing the drugs directly or by having that conversation, referral discussion with the primary care physician, who can then coordinate the medications to make sure that there aren't other drugs that are in play to get those drugs ordered. It's a little bit complicated with some of the very dangerous psychotropic drugs where the communication, long-distance communication, and getting those prescriptions written to the patient, to the pharmacy, so that the drugs and prescriptions can be filled, because they're not the type of drugs that allow just anybody to pick up the phone and call a pharmacy and say, I'd like to order such and such a drug. They are the controlled substances that require the actual prescription document to be taken to the pharmacy. So it gets a little more complicated, but something that through planning and logistics can be addressed.
It sounds like communication also would be key in this. I mean, what do you have in place and what sort of systems are there to make sure that, you know, the doctors in Springfield know and understand what's happening, and the primary care physicians on the end there in Havana, you know what has gone on and have access to records and those things as well?
Not just that. I mean, it's a question of making sure that the records are available in a timely manner down in Springfield so that they know the other activities that are going on, the other drugs the patients are on, the other medical conditions, and how those treatments are going. And then similarly, getting copies of those reports back after the session is completed. It's one of the advantages of having the counselor present while this is going on, because many of these patients, in addition to their visit with the psychiatrist, have visits with a counselor who's helping them through some of the other challenges that they're dealing with, or in some cases a nurse who would be in the room to address some of the medical issues, to make sure that communication and that the transfer of records is up to date and current.
How do you assure ultimate responsibility, I guess, for the patient's care with all these different sort of elements there? Who's kind of the final say?
Well, it's always a challenge. We are a strong and very active proponent that the patient's primary care physician is in the best position to overall have responsibility for managing their care. We have a medical home concept within our practice that kind of thrives within that concept. But we also recognize the importance of the specialist as being uniquely qualified to deal with some of those unique medical problems that the patients are dealing with. So you're right, it is very much a communication. At the end of the day, the patient is the person. They are the ones who are in charge of what medical care they will receive. That's why having an advocate who is going to, you know, as we heard earlier in the show, an advocate who is going to take that personal interest to make sure that the care that is being provided is the best care for that individual. We all have some personal responsibility we have to take for our care. It becomes very challenging when we're being told perhaps different things by different physicians, which is why, again, we have fallen back and set up our processes based on the medical home model that says that the patient's primary care physician is in the best position to help the patient sort those sometimes conflicting, but usually not, but always complicated issues out and helping the patient understand
And some of these
their ability.
Complexities and things, that's not at all unique to telepsychiatry. I mean, those same things need to be worked out between primary care physicians and even if I were to go see a psychiatrist, you know, right down the street, you know, those same issues come up. So it's, you know, we should be fair there as well.
And sometimes because we are far away, we focus on it a little more, and therefore it becomes a little more cognizant for us than if it was just somebody around the corner where it's out of sight, out of mind. But we know we've got those challenges, so we tend to focus on them a little more.
Yeah, and build in those systems. We're talking today about the promise, the limits of telemedicine and telepsychiatry. If you work in mental health, if you're a patient, know somebody who is, have you tried telepsychiatry? Tell us your story. Would you, if it was offered to you? Give us a call, 800-222-9455. You can also reach us by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. And join the conversation on Twitter. Our producer, Lindsay Moon, over there right now, at Focus580, hashtag WillChat. We're talking with Harry Wallen, CEO. You just heard his voice, CEO of Mason District Hospital in Havana, Illinois. Donna Mayer with us here in the studio, cares for her son with a mental illness. Also, Dr. Jeffrey Bennett, assistant professor of psychiatry at Southern Illinois University School of Medicine in Springfield and acting chief of the Adult Psychiatry Division at SIU School of Medicine there as well. Coming back to you, Dr. Bennett, here for a moment, on the business side of this, there has been some movement lately, but the fact remains right now, insurance coverage is not always there for telepsychiatry. Where does that stand?
Right now, as a member of the Illinois Psychiatric Society's General Counsel, I'm working with our executive director to develop and pass legislation which would enable third-party payers to pay for psychiatric services through telepsychiatry, just like they would pay for them if they were face-to-face, and that's an ongoing effort. It's happened in many states so far, but I think working it through here in Illinois is one of our next steps.
And it sounds like the industry is, to some degree, is involved too and are not opposing this. Is that true?
There's a great deal of support from the industry. I think that they recognize that this is a way to prevent hospitalizations that may be unnecessary, to prevent comorbidity. So, for instance, somebody that has a psychiatric disorder may not take as good self-care, and if their psychiatric disorder can be treated, then it lowers the amount of supervision and excessive amounts of or the healthcare burden that may be required. So there's really a win-win situation at stake here. I think the problem is rolling out such services in a way that is cost savings and doesn't require a tremendous amount of expenditure. And so developing a system and passing the legislation and getting the rules in place is really kind of a long process.
Harry Wolin, for you there in Havana at Mason District Hospital, is there a business model here? Is this affordable? Is it sustainable?
Not yet.
Tough question.
I mean,
and is that a goal? I mean, maybe that may not be the goal.
Well, it has to be a goal. The challenge becomes if it is not something that is adequately paid for by somebody, then it will not be able to be sustained on a long-term basis. We use this program as clearly a community service that we provide for as part of our mission to our community and our efforts to meet the health needs of the community. But it nowhere near is even close to something that is self-sustaining. We look at our other operations and the cost that we would be incurring, if not for this patient, to help us understand the need for it. Now, there's no question as to the need for the service for the patients, but when we look at where we expend our resources and which community needs we can afford to support and underwrite, it becomes part of that strategic, there's only so much resources we have, and how is the best way for us to spend them for the needs in our community? And there are a lot of needs, all of which you can make a very compelling case as to why help is needed to eradicate this problem, that problem, a long list of medical and social ills that impact people's health.
It sounds like you face some tough decisions.
Based on our internal discussions, but if it doesn't become self-sustaining, the real question becomes is how long can we continue to provide the service?
And then what happens if you can't, knowing that we've talked about some of these access issues already? You know, where does that go? Do you see any support coming in? I mean, we have the insurance companies in the state pushing on that. Is there grant funding? Is there federal funding? Are there other options for to push this through? The USDA recently committed $50 million to specifically rural mental health issues.
Yeah, I mean, there are grants. I mean, our original equipment that we purchased for the program was obtained through a grant. And so it's not that there aren't some supports for it, but the ongoing costs of the program significantly outscore the revenues that we generate for it. And so, yeah, it becomes a very real budgetary question that we deal with on an ongoing basis. There's no question as to the need. The need is very compelling. On a long-term basis, though, the question can always be, where are those other needs? Because there are other needs that are going unmet because we've chosen to meet this health need. There is a bill in the Illinois Assembly as we speak that made it out of committee and is in the process of making coverage for telemedicine services a requirement of third-party payers.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, Medicaid pays, but many of the and some insurance companies do pay, but many others do not. And the bill that has some technical pieces in terms of making the logistics of telemedicine a little easier, but on the financial side would make coverage for telemedicine a requirement of insurance companies.
Do you have any idea at this point, just looking at the budget and the challenges that you face, how long you can keep this going at this rate?
Well, no. I mean, that's a tough question. I mean, it begs the broader question of healthcare financing, which is not a simple question to address. We serve a rural part of the state with a very high level of poverty, high level of folks without insurance are doing it in a very compelling way to try and do it in a high quality, state-of-the-art mechanism using technology where we see fit. But the challenges are very real that go beyond just a discussion of mental illness, although mental illness is a very high challenge on the issues of problems facing rural communities and their health unmet health needs.
And, Dr. Bennett, we just have a couple of minutes left here, but it makes me think, you know, you teach students, you work with future psychiatrists. Do these issues of shortages and access to care come up? Do you ever talk about practicing in rural communities?
Absolutely.
What are those conversations like?
Well, there are several challenges. One is that primary care physicians deliver most of the mental health care as far as prescription medications right now. And one of the goals, I think, of telepsychiatry is to enable psychiatric consultation to take place for those primary care physicians who are really holding the front line and enable them to prescribe medications in a safe way and to be sure that a proper differential diagnosis has been made for patients that present primarily with psychiatric complaints. I think the other thing is that there are interactions between the psychiatric medications, as Harry mentioned, and many medical conditions. And so as a psychiatrist, we're experts in working with patients that have medical conditions and working with patients that might have medical conditions that give rise to the psychiatric situation. So those kinds of services, I think, are needed in the patient-centered medical home. And this collaborative care model is one way that services can be provided, but still localized where patients come.
All right. So it's we know the challenges. There's agreement on the challenges. This is an option to be able to reach some of those places. They're still figuring out, in many ways, the business model, the financial aspects, the insurance aspects, which is true of health care in so many different ways right now. Donna Mayer from Coles County cares for her son with a mental illness. Thank you for joining us. Harry Wallen serves as CEO of Mason District Hospital in Havana, Illinois, a hospital that is offering telepsychiatry. And the voice you just heard, Dr. Jeffrey Bennett, he serves as acting chief of the Adult Psychiatry Division at Southern Illinois University School of Medicine in Springfield. Thank you all for your time today.
Thank you.
You're more than welcome.
And even though we're out of time here on the air, we're continuing this conversation on Twitter. It's all part of our series, Unmet Needs, Living with Mental Illness in Central Illinois. Lindsay Moon and Sean Powers hosting a Twitter chat today, right now, for the next hour to talk about mental illness and stigma in the community. What have been your experience? Tweet us. Use the hashtag WillChat. I'm Scott Cameron. This is Focus from Illinois Public Media.